Thank you for your support for and contributions to our KHSU Fall Fund Drive. And also thank you for staying with KHSU on your Tuesday, the 9th of October. I'm Wendy Butler, and you've got Art Waves. Today, two interviews for you. Later in the program, we'll hear from Which Way the Wind play director, John Heckel. Which Way the Wind is the centerpiece of the Against the Wind Festival, which begins this Sunday, October 14th, and continues through the 21st. Which Way the Wind will be performed October 19th through the 21st at the Arcata Playhouse. First on the program today, Sing Our Rivers Red is a traveling earring exhibit whose purpose is to bring awareness to the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and colonial gender-based violence across North America. It is currently on display at Humboldt State University's Gooditni Gallery through Friday, October 19th. There are several events being held in connection with this exhibit. In the studio with me to talk about the exhibit and those events is HSU Native American Studies Chairperson, Dr. Kacha Risling Baldy. She begins with expanding on what she considers this exhibit's purpose.
I believe that the exhibit is a really great way of expressing the very personal connections that we have to missing and murdered Indigenous women. It humanizes them as more than statistics. It shows that they're real people. They come from real families and real communities, people that care about them, people that miss them, and people that don't want anyone to forget that they are still missing and that they were murdered. And I see the exhibit as a very powerful way of showing everyone that people are trying to do something. They're trying to call attention to this because in both the United States and Canada, it is Indigenous peoples that are the most likely to be victims of violence and assault and sexual assault. And we still have issues with the protection of people through the law. There's loopholes in the law that allow this to continue. And I think because of that, we have an epidemic of people that go missing and murdered. And they tend to be the ones that aren't mentioned on the news and that don't have large movements built around them. And so rather than to say that we should be silent about that, this exhibit says that we need to show that these are real people that come from real places.
And I was looking on the Sing Our Rivers Red website, and I would like your help with this. It wrote about MMIW Awareness Day. There is writing about proclamations dating back to 2015, but I couldn't find when the Awareness Day is. So when is the Awareness Day?
They tend to do the Awareness Day for missing and murdered Indigenous women on May 5th. And what they do is they ask people to wear red because red has sort of become a color that we wear to empower ourselves, but also to call attention to this. And then they have people hold candlelight vigils or events that call attention to this ongoing problem. Last year, the students at Humboldt State actually got together to post up different signs that actually had information, statistics about what face missing and murdered Indigenous peoples, and to give people this idea that like this is actually an ongoing problem. And then they asked people if they would wear red on May 5th and gather for a vigil and a talk about this issue. So it's a way of bringing people together to show that people care about this issue, that it is something that we should be thinking about and should be doing something about.
During the events that were held here at Humboldt State University on May 5th, did you notice that non-Native as well as Native peoples gathered?
Yes. I think that there was a good participation in those activities. And I was really proud of the way that the students made these posters that sort of showed the actual statistics of what people are facing and put them all over campus just to start to get people thinking about what was going on. And then I think it did have more and more people sort of curious about what this was and asking more questions, which is important. And I know that in Native American Studies, many of our classes talk specifically about the legal loopholes and the continuing policies that sort of that allow this to happen to Indigenous peoples, the ties that this has to extractive industries, the fact that where extractive industries pop up, you see more missing and murdered Indigenous women. And in our classes, we explore that connection between ongoing colonialism, ongoing federal Indian law issues, and why that's important today and how that affects real people and real communities.
Another thing that I noticed on the SORR website was values. Values, and it began with heal us. Humility, empowerment, accessibility, love and compassion, unity, support and membership. But the heal us, I think that it's something that can unite people of all different cultures, if the idea is not to be divisive, but to heal.
And I think that this is something important that runs throughout everyone's lives. And I think that we're seeing it more and more with what's going on in the news today. It is important how we treat our women. It is important how we treat our girls. It is important the way that we understand the role of equality and what that is supposed to look like. It's important that we acknowledge that, I mean, across the board, it is women that are facing the high rates of sexual assault and violence. It is women that are murdered and usually in domestic violence type of situations. And I think that when you're talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women, what you're saying is, see, in this country, we are ignoring that this kind of issue, it goes out everywhere. If one woman goes missing and is murdered, that affects an entire community. And we need to all heal from that. That's not just about the one person. And you see kind of all of these interconnections that happen between people when they're able to start telling their stories.
Now, earrings are a demonstrable part of this exhibit. Also are still being sought for the sewing circles as well. So I would like you, if you could, talk about the symbolic nature of the earrings.
It's a pretty grand and powerful exhibit, and I hope that everyone goes to it. What the original premise of it was asking people to send in their other earring. And so the idea is, when you wear earrings a lot, what happens is you tend to lose them sometimes, but you always only lose one, and you always have the other one with you, and you kind of don't know what to do with them. And so they were asking people to send in their earrings that they still had, and to say, sort of in this very symbolic way, you have this one that's missing and you don't know where it is and you don't know how to find it. And then you still have this other one. And so let's send them in as this representation of like the missing people, the missing and murdered Indigenous women. And they put out a call very early, this was years ago, and said, I would just like people to send in their earrings so that we can start to represent these women. And so many people participated. It's very much a community effort of sending in earrings and having them be a part of this exhibit. They're from all over the world, of people sending in earrings to say, I do want people to go to these exhibits and see this representation of these missing women. I think that the exhibit itself, it is a place of great power, and it behooves people who go to remind themselves to, and I think that's one of the reasons why the value is there, to enter with humility, because these are people who are being represented who do belong to a community and a family. And along with the exhibit, they include letters, sometimes of support, but sometimes stories about their own family members that are missing and that have been murdered. And so when you go into that space, that all of that power is there. And it makes sure to remind you that that this is real. So it makes tangible what missing can be, what missing and murdered feels like. And then asking people to send in more and more earrings has become part of the exhibit. And I think that I would highly encourage, because they are still looking for earrings for Humboldt State, hopefully to become part of a more permanent exhibit on campus. And so they're asking people to send in, and everybody has that one or two earrings they're holding on to. They have the side that they lost, but they have the other side, so that they can also feel as if they've contributed and become a part of this exhibit that is calling attention to this issue.
And the sewing circle, there are sewing circles happening. Well, at the time that this airs, it'll be tomorrow. So it's on Wednesday, October 10th. From 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. and Thursday, October 11th, 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. And that's in the gallery.
Yes, and so people can come, and what they're doing is they're sewing the donated earrings onto a permanent type exhibit, and everybody can participate in that. It's a way to sort of bring the community together to make a more permanent exhibit. So they'll be sewing the earrings actually onto blankets. And I would encourage people to come to that, but to also bring as many earrings as they can, because I know that we're still looking for more and more donations of earrings to be able to make that exhibit happen.
And then the gallery talk is on October 12th, Friday, October 12th.
The talk on Friday is it starts at 12:30. It's in the Goudini Gallery, and it features a woman doing her doctoral research on missing and murdered Indigenous women. She's working to create a database of missing and murdered Indigenous women in the United States. There's not a comprehensive database of how many women we're talking about when we're saying this. A lot of these are based on estimates. Nobody's really done the work yet to bring all of this together to show what a comprehensive issue this is in the United States. And then she's also working off of that database in which she's collecting this information to create GIS maps of where missing and murdered Indigenous women are from, and you know where these issues are sort of really concentrated, and to start to show how we can start to approach this issue from like a policy or a community-based standpoint. She's collecting this information both through research through like archives and police reports, but also just through community outreach. And so asking community members to report on their own family or things that have happened or things that they know about, so she can maybe pick up on stories that haven't really been featured in like newspapers or through archival materials. So she's trying to do really comprehensive work on missing and murdered Indigenous women in the United States and then turning that into a mapping project.
Now, the individual you're talking about is Anita.
Yes.
Lucchesi.
Yes.
And but also Allie Hostler is going to be there as well.
Yes, and Allie Hostler is actually, she's the editor of the Two Rivers Tribune from the Hoopa Valley. And she has been doing a lot of research on especially this area of Humboldt County and missing and murdered Indigenous women. We are not immune in Humboldt County to this ongoing issue. We do have very high rates of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Humboldt County and in this region.
And finally, what I'd like you to, as department chair of Native American Studies here at Humboldt State University, I want you to talk about how this exhibit, Sing Our Rivers Red, how it connects with the educational mission of Native American Studies here at the university.
You know, I think that exhibits like this, especially for students, help them to see that there are many ways in which they can approach this question of what do we do? Because we teach them a lot about history, we teach them a lot about sort of the ongoing settler colonialism that sets up this system that allows people to commit crimes on Indian land and not be prosecuted, that builds a system that says that it's okay to take children away from their families if they're Native American. We give them a lot of historical context. We bring them up to a contemporary issues that are ongoing in the Supreme Court, that are ongoing in federal courts. And we try to tell them, like, these are issues you need to know about as you go out into the world. Whatever job you're going to do, you are going to do it on Indian land. You're going to do it in Indian spaces. And you need to know about this history. You need to know about what it is that you're dealing with now. And a lot of the times that leads students to the question of, well, what do we do? And what can we do? Because it feels so overwhelming. And I think that these kinds of exhibits sort of show them that there are many ways to approach this, what do we do? And they all make really necessary interventions and impacts on community experience to say that something needs to happen and that there are people all over the place on the ground that will contribute to making something happen. And that's why I really like that we have been able to bring in so many of these Native-focused exhibits into the Goudini Gallery, because it gives students ways that artists are intervening and building a conversation to see that the arts can make a real contribution and impact to public policy, to what we understand, to sort of what we're going to do in our own communities.
Dr. Kacha Risling-Baldi, chairperson of the Humboldt State University Native American Studies Department. Sing Our Rivers Red through Friday, October 19th at HSU's Gooditni Gallery, located on 17th and Union Streets on the ground floor of the Behavioral and Social Sciences Building. Again, earrings are still being sought for permanent display at the gallery. Also, the sewing circles at the gallery are tomorrow at 10 a.m. and Thursday at 2 p.m. And the gallery talk on the MMIW database and the mapping project is this Friday, October 12th, noon to 1:30 p.m. at the gallery. For more information on gallery hours and these events, you can call the gallery office at 826-3529. Or you can email hsugalleries@gmail.com. I'm Wendy Butler, and you're listening to Art Waves on KHSU. Up now, another installment of my coverage of the Against the Wind Festival, a week-long festival beginning this Sunday, October 14th, and going through the 21st. And it was created by local volunteers, and it raises funds for the multiple-year journey of the Golden Rule Peace Boat. The week-long events take place at the Arcata Playhouse and also at the HSU Kate Buchanan Room. Among the events is the revival of the anti-nuclear play, Which Way the Wind, and it will be performed Friday, October 19th through Sunday the 21st at the Arcata Playhouse. My guest is its director, John Heckel. Why did you want to take this project on?
Well, Jack Irvine, retired medical doctor in our community, among a number of doctors, peace advocates, socially active. There's a very socially active community of ex-medical people in our community. Bless them all for staying as socially active as they are. He called me up a year and a half ago, and he said, I found this play, would you read this play and look at it and tell me whether it's producible, whether it has any relevance today, whether it works. And the play was written in 1959, and it has a very 1950s sensibility to it. It reflects the 1950s sensibilities to bomb shelters, to duck and cover, and the whole 50s were afraid of nuclear annihilation. It reflects that world. It has 50s language in it. It has a particular style to it. And so he asked me if it was doable, and I read the play, and I said, yes, it's doable, and we met. And he asked me if I would direct it, and I said, yeah, I would direct it. And then he and Peter Aronson and I started meeting, moving this play towards production. And then slowly we saw that grow into a whole week of anti-nuclear activity, with the play culminating the week and the play being at the end of the week.
Now, for the play, given that it was written in the 1950s, and there are perhaps references in it that some might consider dated.
Well, that's a really fascinating thing. There are a couple things, right? It was written in 1959, and it was commissioned by the Quakers. of the United States requested this guy write an anti-nuke play that they wanted to tour. And the character, the man that played the lead role in the play, Bigelow, is also the guy that sailed the Golden Rule into the Marshall Islands.
Yeah, or attempted to.
Or attempted to and got arrested. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, when this play talks about migration to the United States, it has a very, very definite white bias, right? So the migration to the United States is all pretty much has a very strong European bias. It doesn't talk about Mexican migration to the United States, doesn't talk about, right? So we in the cast have gotten together and questions have come up. Do we rewrite sections of the script that was done in the 50s that are today sensitive, politically incorrect? And we got into this discussion, and I said, I don't think a way of dealing with our history is to whitewash it. I think that if you do a play from the 50s and you express this concern about nuclear annihilation that people were expressing in the 50s, then you have to be true to the time period, and you have to be willing to reflect to our sensitivities and insensitivities as we expressed them in the 50s. And some of the language that we used and some of the biases that we had and some of the sensitivities to diversity that we had in the 50s are in the play. I'll give you another example, right? All the female characters in the play are referred to as Mrs. John Madison. Right? They lose their first name. First of all, they don't have a maiden name. They have a married name. But not only do they have a married name, but they lose their own first name and they become Mrs. John Madison. Right? Well, what we try to do in the play, we open the play with the cast members coming onto the stage, one at a time, sharing a very brief personal narrative of where they were in 1959 or where their parents were in 1959. So it's this personal narrative attempt at taking the audience back to the 50s. Come with us. We're going to go back to the 50s and we're going to look at what the concerns of American folks about what their concerns were about nuclear testing, about the end of World War II, the nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. We're going to look at what the concerns of the people in the 50s were. And for instance, one woman in her personal narrative talks about how her mother graduated from the University of California in the 1940s. 15 months later, she became Mrs. Norman Madison. She lost her first name. And by 1959, she was in the kitchen, the mother of four children, cooking the evening meal. All right? Mm-hmm. So it's these kinds of personal narratives at the beginning of the show that are an attempt to draw the audience back into the 50s and recognize that this was indeed the language of the 50s. This was indeed the sensitivities of the people in the 50s. And you can't whitewash it. You can't erase it. You can't go through a script and eliminate all of these things. That's like rewriting history. That's part of the 50s, and that's part of the world we're taking people back to.
Now, in the 2018, what is going on right now is, by virtue of a lot of things, including the voyage of the Golden Rule around the world, is advocating for peace and also protesting a nuclear proliferation.
Yeah. Have you read Woodward's book, Fear?
No, I have not.
I'm halfway through Fear.
Good.
By Woodward. And his accounts of the discussions that the top people in the government had, Trump and his advisors, about striking North Korea and about how close the conversations have come in the last 2 years to starting a military engagement that could lead to a nuclear war are absolutely frightening. So one of the things we hope is that we do the play in such a way that the audience goes, that's still true today. Oh my goodness, not much has changed since 1959 to 2018, 2019. These are still our concerns today. Not much has changed. Maybe the political rhetoric has changed slightly, and we become more politically sensitive to linguistic choices that we make. But the fear of nuclear annihilation and how close people are willing to talk about that kind of military engagement. When you read Woodward's book, it's absolutely scary the conversations that people had and how close they got.
You have an excerpt.
From
Which Way the Wind.
Yeah, this is startling to me in terms of a kind of admission that comes from the 50s. This is the 50s kind of admitting to something, right? Of all the delusions that could be our undoing, this may be the chief, that we are a peaceful people. Only fierce when someone picks on us beyond our saints' endurance. We, the great peaceful American family, sitting in our peaceful homes, peacefully watching television, which incidentally offers for our delight an average of 300 stories per week of assorted mayhem. A peaceful people. Exporting to the world year after year our movies where the problems, social problems, political problems, racial problems, all is resolved by the fists of the hero. Well, of course, that's fiction. In the newspapers, the muggings, the beatings, the stabbings, and the shooting, America has always had its share of violence. As far back as 1834, New York had 17 murders to one in London. And in the villages, Tombstone, Dodge City, Deadwood, Hangtown, out there in God's country, war raged for years with even the good guys, the vigilantes, a menace, until the people had to reject violence to survive. Slowly, stubbornly, the funny preachers and the hymn singers, the lawyers, the school teachers, and the ladies established the courts and orders.
Which Way the Wind.
Which Way the Wind.
John Heckel, who directs Which Way the Wind, performing Friday, October 19th through Sunday, October 21st at the Arcata Playhouse as part of the Against the Wind Festival. The Friday and Saturday performances of the play are at 8 p.m. and Sundays is at 2 p.m. And there's a talk back scheduled following every performance of the play. For tickets, as well as information on the complete list of Against the Wind Festival events, from this Sunday, October 14th through Sunday, October 21st, you can visit againstthewindfestival.org. That's all the time we have today. Art Waves is broadcast each Tuesday at 1:30 p.m., available anytime at khsu.org, and podcasts of this program are available for download from iTunes. Until next time, I'm Wendy Butler. Thank you for listening.